The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In this time of pandemic, the streets of New York City now are so desolate, you half expect tumbleweed to blow along the pavement where cars and cabs once clustered. You hear the wheeze of an empty bus rounding the corner, the flutter of pigeons on the fire escape, the wail of an ambulance, unnervingly frequent. For weeks as the pandemic took hold, a sax player who stakes his corner outside a dress shop on Broadway was still there, playing My Favorite Things and All the Things You Are. Now he's gone too. The spectacle of New York without New Yorkers is the result of a social pact. We've absented ourselves from the schools and the playgrounds, the ballparks and the bars, the places where we work, because life now depends on our withdrawal from life. The vacancy of our public spaces is antithetical to the very purpose of the city, which is defined by its encounters, their constancy, and their poetry. But the vacancy of the city is what's needed to preserve it. And so you stick your head out the window of an apartment that you have not left in days. You see a single scurrying soul, her arms full of groceries. She's wearing a mask and walking with the urgency of a thief. She quickens her step as she crosses Broadway, past magnolias blooming on the traffic divider. And like all of us, she's trying to outrun a thing that she cannot see. E.B. White wrote in the summer of 1948, "On any person who desires such queer prizes, New York will bestow the gift of loneliness and the gift of privacy." But these prizes are now a public health requirement. We chafe at the solitude. We try to overcome it with technology. We text. We Zoom. We send links about virology. We are all immunologists now. We watch televised briefings as long as art house movies. But then something happens. Joy comes at 7, or is it sheer catharsis? At 7 o'clock in neighborhoods across the city, cheering breaks out as though the Yankees had clinched the World Series. It spills from the stoops and the sidewalks, from apartment windows and rooftops. We take out our smartphones and start recording the roar, the clapping, the whooping, the tambourines and the wind chimes, the vuvuzelas. The guy across the street is a master of the cowbell, and we don't mind. Before it all dies down, we've sent the recording to a loved one who works in an ER, and we send it to others who are sick in bed or out of range of our dense and canyon city. The city described on the news as the epicenter. The cheering is for all the nurses, orderlies, doctors, EMTs. It's for the courage of professionals who may work without the protective gear that they need. Some of them have seen their salaries cut. Some have fallen ill, and others soon will. We're applauding Anthony Fauci, who must spend nearly as much mental energy trying to finesse the ignorance and the ego of his commander-in-chief as he does in assessing the course of the virus. We're cheering researchers in labs all over the world who are at work on treatments or vaccines. We're cheering people who make the city work at their peril. Grocery clerks and ambulance drivers, sanitation workers, pharmacists and mail carriers, truckers, cops, firemen, the delivery man who shrugs off the straps of his knapsack and jabs at the intercom buzzer with a gloved finger. We cheer those who provide straight information and look out for the most vulnerable among us, the poor, the aged, the incarcerated. And we cheer the artists who have lost their gigs but are posting paintings on Instagram, FaceTiming their soliloquies, singing into iPhones. We know the limits of this release, this cheering. There's a feeling of helplessness reflected in it too. But it's what we have in a dark time. Even the president has appeared to bow before the reality that as many as 100,000 or 200,000 of us could die in this pandemic. These coming weeks are and will be demanding in ways that few of us could have anticipated. If New Yorkers are in hiding, the virus has shown a knack for seeking. But with time and discipline, life will return to the city, our city and your city. The doors will open and we'll leave our homes. We'll greet our friends face-to-face at long-delayed Easter services and Passover seders. Children will go to class with their teachers. Sidewalks and stores and theaters will fill. One day, remnants of the crisis will be tucked away, out of sight and out of mind. A box of gloves, a bag of makeshift masks, containers of drying Clorox wipes. We'll forget a lot about our city's suspended life, but we'll remember who we lost. We will remember the terrible cost of time squandered, and we'll remember the sound of 7 o'clock. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. On first glance, COVID-19 seems to be indifferent to who we are. Princes and prime ministers, musicians and Hollywood A-listers, NBA players, all sorts of prominent people have made headlines for contracting the virus. But when we look at the numbers of illnesses and fatalities, we see something else distinct emerge. We see the inequality that's part of the American healthcare system. We find the kinds of disparities that cause worse outcomes in many different ways for people who are disadvantaged. Kianga Yamada Taylor has written for many publications, including The New Yorker, about racial inequality. She's an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton and the author of Race for Profit. I reached her last week. Now, Professor Taylor, there are some really alarming numbers coming in from all over the country which show that minorities, particularly African Americans, are succumbing to COVID-19 at absolutely staggering rates. In Louisiana, African Americans are 33% of the population, but account for 70% of the deaths from coronavirus. And this is all over the place. It's Chicago, in Mississippi, in New York. What factor or combination of factors contributes to this shocking disparity?
So I think that there are a few things. The first thing is that it is almost too easy to point to the kind of underlying conditions that African Americans are particularly vulnerable to, whether that is hypertension, whether it's obesity, asthma, really all of the long-term diseases of disinvestment, underemployment, and in some cases, poverty. Pre-existing conditions don't necessarily make people more vulnerable to the virus, but it means that if you get the virus, that it can have deadly effects. And then we can talk about the inability to practice social distancing. I think as a prerequisite for effective social distancing, you need to have safe, sound, and comfortable housing. You need access to the internet. You need access to computers. And so I think because of the ways that Black people are overrepresented in professions that don't allow for working at home, only 19% of Black people have the ability to work at home because of the types of jobs that they are employed in, jobs that are typically low-waged and degraded, which now, ironically, are seen as essential, work like magnets to pull people away from the safety of social distancing. And so African Americans in New York City, you still must get on the subway to get to work. And so social distancing is critical, but you have to have a certain kind of income and class position, really, to be able to fully engage that practice.
How does this manifest itself in terms of our healthcare system, in terms of institutional racism and our healthcare system?
Well, there, I think you see both the dynamics of class, but also race. I think it's important to say that 10% of African Americans are uninsured. And then there have been several reports of Black women in particular with health insurance who show up to the hospital with the classic, now classic symptoms of COVID and are turned away repeatedly and are only getting tested at the very, you know, final hours when it's much too late. So there is a legacy within healthcare practice of not believing Black patients when they talk about pain, not really taking seriously the complaints from Black patients. So I think that that is a way in which racial issues transcend the obvious class problems in a for-profit healthcare system.
Do we know how testing for coronavirus is being deployed in poor and minority neighborhoods?
I'm not sure if we have a full picture. There was a scientist at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and he found that in zip codes with higher incomes, testing was six times higher than in zip codes with lower incomes and lower rates of insurance. You know, there are these drive-up testing facilities that have been created in cities around the country, but, you know, it assumes that you have a car to be able to use that. But given the dearth of tests that are available, I can imagine that for the poorest people, those who are most disconnected from the networks where one might find out about where to go to get tested, how to get tested, that the numbers are even lower than they are for the general public.
I want to ask a question about housing. I've read your really excellent book on race and housing. In looking at this crisis and the shocking infection and death rates for minorities, do you see the legacy of redlining there, and how so?
Well, I think, I mean, there's so many overlapping issues. I think with redlining, we know that residential segregation cuts people off from good jobs, from high-paying jobs, from opportunities that could actually improve life chances. And so I think segregation is not just about the relegation of African Americans to a particular city or suburb. It's about the consequences of that. Also, you know, somewhere like Philadelphia, there are literally thousands of apartments in this city. I'm in Philadelphia. That have been legally designated unfit for human habitation by the city of Philadelphia. But the city does nothing to act on that, because to close these apartments would be to exacerbate a crisis of homelessness that already exists. But part of the reason for many of these places why they are considered unfit for human habitation is because they don't have proper plumbing. They don't have proper access to water. And so that is of even more critical importance right now. We think about people in Flint, Michigan. We think about people in Detroit, thousands of Black people whose water, access to potable water, has been shut off at a time when we are being told to wash our hands as much as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. When we are being told to practice good hygiene. So all of these issues are intersecting in the most destructive and catastrophic way that we could imagine.
It's very hard to talk about hope on days when the death count is so, so high in New York and around the country and around the world, too, but particularly in the United States. But does the fact that this has laid bare so many inequalities in this country, does it give you any hope that when we get around the corner of this, that the discussion about inequality and about race will change in any profound way?
First of all, this is not the first time that the horrors of American inequality have been exposed to people. In 2005, the catastrophe of Hurricane Katrina, you know, as Danny Glover said, revealed a third world country in the midst of the United States. I think even in the 2008 financial crisis, and the ways that some people were more devastated than others, also created important insights into American poverty, things that under normal circumstances go completely ignored. So just knowing about it is not enough. And I think social crises almost always provoke a social response. It's complicated to imagine what that will look like right now because of social distance. So we can't all just go to City Hall and shake our fists. We can't all just mobilize and take buses to Washington, D.C. to express our outrage at the sclerotic pace of aid for people on the ground. And so for me, I mean, I do have hope. I have hope not based in some kind of cheap religiosity, but hope that is rooted in an understanding of history and the history of ordinary people really leading the way to find solutions to the social dilemmas of, you know, whatever period or circumstance that they emerge in. We can see the very basic gestures of solidarity, whether it is the selfless acts of healthcare professionals, people who are trying to procure food and other resources for the elderly. I mean, there are all sorts of examples that we can point to that show the basic decency of regular people in this society. So that's where I do have hope.
Professor Taylor, thank you so much. Kianga Yamada Taylor is a contributor to The New Yorker, and she's an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton. Her most recent book is titled Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermine Black Home Ownership. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Ian Lee's short stories have appeared in The New Yorker for more than 15 years. Lee is also a professor of creative writing at Princeton University.
Well, are you in Princeton now? Is that right?
I am. Yeah.
And the campus is empty? Everyone's gone home?
The campus is empty. The city is quiet. It's different. It has a different feeling. And it's a good time to read War and Peace.
A good time to read War and Peace. Tolstoy's 1,200-page epic about Russia during the Napoleonic Wars. When the coronavirus outbreak began, that was the book Ian Lee reached for.
The novel started with Annette, you know, having a cough, and she said she was sick. She couldn't go out to party, so she invited people to her house for a party, and everybody came. I mean, I have read it novels so many times. This is the only time I thought, oh, you know, a cough really means something. And these people really should be careful about life.
Around the time that we were all retreating into our homes last month, Ian Lee launched a project called Tolstoy Together. It's kind of an online book club. The New Yorker's Josh Rothman is a Tolstoy fanatic. And he recently talked with Ian Lee about the new project.
What was it about War and Peace that made you think this is the book that I want to be reading now?
One is it's a long book, and I thought I do think there are people who have always meant to read it, but who have not picked it up, and so this is a good time. And the other thing I really like about Tolstoy is he's such a solid writer, and War and Peace has this reliable structure, you know, peace and war and peace and war. I feel like I can just put my trust into Tolstoy's words. Mm. You know, in other moments of my life, when I was really agitated, I would hand copy War and Peace, you know, passage that I love, just to keep like the hand moving or keep the mind moving. It has that kind of support for a mind. So I thought I would go back to War and Peace, and I thought I could invite 5-10 people to read with me like a book club. And a lot of people responded and people really loved it. So it became a bigger thing than I originally imagined.
So how many people are reading it with you now?
You know, our estimate is like on and off, maybe about 3,000 people. And we counted probably 20 countries, all the continents except Antarctica.
That's so cool. And so how does it work?
So, you know, I calculated, I thought we probably will be stuck for 2 or 3 months just looking at the data from other countries. If we read 12 to 15 pages a day, which takes about 30 minutes, that will take us about 12 weeks to finish the book. Then we'll be in the summer, and my hope is by then we will all be free to walk around and enjoy life. So that's how I propose. We're just going to read 12 to 15 pages a day. And at the beginning of the day, I would post 3 thoughts from me. These happened on Twitter and Instagram. And then for the rest of the day, people would chime in, people would question, put their questions or observations. So it's quite like a big party, like at the beginning of War and Peace, everybody's talking.
It just sounds great. You and I know this is a crazy question because because War and Peace is like the world's biggest book. But I mean, could you try to just give us a summary of what it's about for people who haven't read it?
Well, it's about the war between, you know, France and Russia during the Napoleon time. And the peace part is about Russian, you know, families living through actually the war. And the war part is really about the war between the two countries. So that's a very bad summary of the novel.
Do you have a favorite character?
I love Pierre. I have such a soft spot for him. And the first time when he was introduced, there was a sentence said, "He did not, as they say, know how to enter a salon, and still less did he know how to leave one." So he has that awkwardness and reminds me of Winnie the Pooh, when Winnie the Pooh went to Rabbit's house, ate too much and got stuck in the hole, rabbit hole. And you know, he has that endearing quality, a little bit awkward, but he also had, you know, deeper, you know, spiritual quality. So I think he is one of the characters, you know, that he always offers comfort to me.
The thing that I remember finding most surprising about War and Peace when I started it was, to me, War and Peace had always been sort of a joke of a book. Like if you had to choose out of the air the name of a really heavy book, you would choose War and Peace. That was kind of like what it was before I, you know, when I was a young person, before I actually read Tolstoy. And then as soon as you start reading the book, it's just almost immediately obvious that it's going to be incredibly suspenseful and entertaining, and that also very obviously about things that are important and meaningful to you.
The book has a bad reputation. You know, I mean, I love a lot of books, but I never get bored reading War and Peace. Every page, there's something new. There's something that engages my curiosity, or something makes me laugh. Yeah, I would just read the page I'm on today. This is, you know, when the Russian army went to war with France for the first time. So do you mind if I read aloud to you? Yeah. So, "At the bend of the Danube, one could see boats and an island, and a castle with a park, surrounded by the waters of the Enns falling into the Danube. One could see the left bank of the Danube, rocky and covered with pine forest, with a mysterious distance of green treetops and bluish gorges. One could see the towers of a convent looming up from the pine forest with its wild and untouched look, and far away on a hilltop on the other side of the Enns, one could see the mounted patrols of the enemy." That's just, you know, it has this beautiful long shot of the scenery, the almost like the untouched, mysterious thing. And then all of a sudden, we actually saw the French patrols just inside. You know, I think Tolstoy certainly is the best seer, and he sees everything.
Well, I mean, I was thinking, there's times when things happen in the world, like 9/11 comes to mind, I guess, but there's many other times when it just seems like hard to think about other things, or hard to make room for certain types of emotions or certain types of thoughts. It's like the world gets compressed down to this kind of narrow stream of concerns. And one of the things that I always like in Tolstoy, and I think this is especially true in War and Peace, is that never happens. So that even though the war is happening, people still are falling in love. They're singing songs. They're living in nature. I'll never forget, there's this scene where Andre he's visiting the Rostov family.
Oh, yes.
And on, there's an oak tree, this like gnarly, old looking tree. I think he stays the night in the house. He'll remember better than me.
And he stayed in the Rostov's house, yes.
Yeah, and he hears Natasha singing from the room below, I think. And it's just beautiful, and it's not about war, you know, it's just a beautiful song. And then on the way out, he goes by the same tree and he sees it's flowering.
Yes.
But it's about, you know, the world continues. There's still youth and beauty and nature and everything.
you know, that is such a good example. You know, when he was listening to Natasha, there was a moment his window was shuttered. So he opened the shutter and the moonlight rushed in that moment. I just thought it was, yes, people are still living their lives during that war.
I mean, for me, and maybe for other people, this is a, it really feels like we're living during history. And we're alive during this time that is the type of thing that, you know, people will read about later.
Yes, I think you're right. You know, there are a lot of resonance between the novel and what we have been through, the panic, the anxiety, and the uncertainty, of course. You know, we have to live through this pandemic. We have to live through this history, just as we have to live through that war. We have to read through that war part of the book.
So, I mean, what I have to say, like what we're doing now, just talking about this book, it's incredibly enjoyable. And it makes me think about what role talking about art has at a time like this. You know, you've convened this group of people who now have a time of their day set aside to communicate with one another about art and literature.
In a way, I realized there's so much comfort. Like people around the world, they could all feel stuck. And if they can read slowly 12, 15 pages and they all talk about these 12, 15 pages, it just offers something for people to talk about other than what's happening outside. And I think whether it's a distraction or, you know, it's just a mitigation of the anxiety, it's really bringing people together. And there are people who would say, you know, I'm so looking forward to tomorrow's pages.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ian. This was incredibly enjoyable.
I enjoyed it so much. I hope we can meet someday.
The writer Ian Lee, talking with The New Yorker's Josh Rothman about Tolstoy's War and Peace. If you want to participate in Lee's project, Tolstoy Together, and maybe you can catch up with them. You can find the information on our website, newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Around this time of year would have been a joyful one, the start of baseball season. Not the worst casualty of this pandemic by far, but for a fan, the loss of baseball is a bitter pill, the deprivation of a really beautiful distraction. And there's talk that maybe the season will open in June, but that's really impossible to know. Until then, I wanted to revisit a conversation I had with the great baseball writer Roger Angel, who is now 99. A few years ago, I brought Roger to the studio to talk about his long and remarkable career at the magazine. In more than seven decades, he's contributed fiction, movie reviews, comic poems, essays about aging and loss. There really isn't a genre that he hasn't touched. But on the subject of baseball, there's no greater writer than Roger. No one. And for this, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2014.
So this is a thrill for me, as well as an honor. The roster of Spink honorees is stuffed with old heroes of mine, like Red Smith and Tom Meaney, and with baseball writer friends who have also been models and heroes, folks like Jerome Holtzman and Peter Gammons and Bill Madden, who were so quick to put me at my ease in the clubhouse and to fill me in whenever I turned up again. My gratitude always goes back to baseball itself, which turned out to be so familiar and so startling, so spacious and exacting, so easy looking and so heartbreakingly difficult that it filled up my notebooks and seasons in a rush. A pastime indeed.
That was an amazing day, Roger. I just wonder, you know, a year and a half later, looking back at it, what it meant to you. You've been writing about baseball for a long time, since the early 60s.
I was extremely anxious beforehand, and I was anxious about so many friends of mine that were coming up this enormous distance. I thought I was not going to be very good, and I actually was using a little Maalox near the end, and I lost some weight, but the minute I got there, it was just terrific.
But you had to invent a voice for this. You had to figure out a way of covering baseball. God knows that baseball, especially when you began, was the focus for sports writers. And in fact, in the 50s, the prestige sports were boxing.
The best sports guys were in
baseball.
Yeah, in baseball, yeah. I approached it with sheer terror. I didn't know what I was doing. I was a baseball fan. I'd been a writer, but I'd not written about baseball, only a little bit. And I was very self-conscious talking to the players, really quite scared.
Why is that?
Well, I felt that they would know more than I did. They wouldn't. What's this guy doing here? I was shy and a little bit nervous. So what I did was to sit in the stands at first, and because I didn't realize that nobody was writing about the fans, and I was a fan, and I could sit in the stands and be a fan and also be a writer.
Is the press box a bad place to cover things from?
No, I don't think so. But once you get used to it, but I wasn't at ease in the press box yet.
One of the things that always amazed me about your baseball writing is that you have a tone of a happy man, of someone who's going at this at his leisure, and that all the difficulty of writing, which we know to be the case, is somehow way out of the frame. That there is this voice of someone just in love with what he's watching. That's hard to achieve.
Well, it developed over the years. I mean, I didn't really plan it in advance. It was some kind of me.
What was the kind of sports writing that you couldn't stand? What were you trying to avoid?
Actually, when I started, Sean said—
William Shawn, the editor
William
of the magazine
the editor,
for decades.
My editor said, why don't you get on spring training and take a look? And he said, we don't want to be sentimental and we don't want to be a tough guys. You know, the two things to avoid.
And did Sean know anything about baseball?
Nothing. My first piece, he came into my office carrying the galleys. My first piece from that spring training, and he pointed to a place on the page, and he said, what's this? And I looked and I said, that's a double play, Bill. And he said, what's a double play? And I explained it to him, and his cheeks glowed with excitement. It was something new. Yeah.
Did you find it harder to talk with players as time went by, as you got a little older? Did you gravitate more toward coaches and managers than players?
Once they call you sir, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
I gravitated toward good talkers, as I've said before.
But did they thin out, is what I mean? Did the good talkers become less and less numerous?
I think so. It's very, when I got over 80, it was impossible for me to talk to players, really, because they would say, sir. And also, as you've said, the habit of talking openly as a person, not as a very well-paid celebrity, semi-celebrity ball player, is pretty well gone.
It's because it's a big difference when the ball players are making about as much as a solid orthodontist,
sure,
and now they're making as much as an oligarch.
Sure, but you did pay attention, as I did. I would carry notes and write endlessly, like long notes, and keep my ears open and listen for something. I remember being outside the office of Jim Frey, the Kansas City manager, after his great star George Brett had another extraordinary day at the plate. And I'm waiting to go in to see the manager, and there are two old coaches at their lockers just outside the door in their underwear and clogs talking, a couple of country guys. And one of them says to the other, everything that George hits goes through the infield like a stream of milk. And this country image, and I wrote it down. I wrote it down. Wow, thank you.
You wait days for things like that in the nonfiction game. Roger, you practiced nonfiction, as it were, by night and fiction by day. For years and years, you were the fiction editor of The New Yorker. To this day, you read short stories for us and in the fiction department. Was this bred in the bone with you? I think some of our listeners will know that your mother was really had singular responsibility for introducing serious fiction to The New Yorker. Catherine White was the person who brought real fiction to The New Yorker. And you must have grown up hearing about this process and knowing this process.
My stepfather was E.B. White, who was E.B. White and writing for the magazine every week. And my mother and stepfather's house was full of galleys and pencils and eraser rubbings and conversation about the magazine and about Harold Russ and about the writers of the day. And sure, I paid close attention, but I wasn't planning to be a New Yorker editor or to be a New Yorker writer.
What were you planning on?
I was hoping to be maybe a boy naturalist, a herpetologist with my first name. But I did pay attention, and my mother was editing Vladimir Nabokov and people like that.
How did Nabokov take editing?
With his usual haughty way, and the famous Nabokov editing was by the great New Yorker founding editor Harold Russ, who loved clarity above all and was not classically or much educated, but loved clearness. And in the middle of some terrific Nabokov memoir, I think part of his Speak Memory pieces, his wonderful memorial memories about his family. There's a line at the dinner table, and somebody says, "Pass the nutcracker." And one of Harold Ross's endless queries, he always had about 20 or 30 queries about every piece of copy. He said, "From the evidence we've been given so far, I would have assumed that the Nabokovs were a more than one nutcracker family." So...
I was looking through some letters that came to Harold Ross, and Roald Dahl, who wrote all those great children's books, but also a number of things for The New Yorker and memoir pieces for The New Yorker, wrote a scathing letter to Ross complaining about the editing and the number of commas that had been injected into things. And he says, it's as if you would take a great comma shaker and sprinkled commas throughout my
copy.
Well,
that was our style, it's lightened up a little bit.
Roger, what is age do for your writing? How does it affect things? How does it either deepen your work or make it more difficult? What's the effect of time on a writer's life?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm aware of my waning powers. I really am, but I'm not writing long pieces. I'm not going out there and write another 10 or 12,000 word baseball piece. I'm not sure.
And that's a matter of what? The getting up and down stadium
steps? Well,
getting
up and doing the interviewing and doing the traveling and taking the time. A lot of hard work. And it's hard for me to get around. It's hard for me to see. It's hard for me to hear a little bit. And I'm doing much. I'm very happy to fall back and do posts and blogs.
Well, this is the amazing thing. You are in your mid-90s. I hope you don't mind me saying. I think you're perfectly aware of it. And yet, sentence by sentence, you're as funny and as touching and as good a writer as you ever were. And you've taken to the internet in a way a lot of people resisted. You took right to it.
Well, I like the brevity of the blog. You can make it quite short. You can just go on as long as you want to go and then just stop. It's sort of like making a paper airplane. No, it's about... I used to love to make paper airplanes. I made great paper airplanes. And you throw it out the window and it goes a little ways or a turn and occurs beautifully and then it goes out of sight and is forgotten forever. And that's like a blog. But
you like the immediacy of the internet?
Yeah.
You're putting up a post and at 6 o'clock it's there and bang, you're getting a...
Well, it's taking me till the middle of the afternoon sometimes. But
fair enough.
But I can sort of see the end when I'm starting, which is not bad.
Now tell me about this new book. You've put together an enormous range of things. You've got in here some obituaries that were published in The New Yorker or online. You've got a couple of long, sustained essays that we'll talk about, some baseball writing.
Letters.
The book is called This Old Man by Roger Angel, All in Pieces.
This Old Man, Roger Angel, All in Pieces. Well, I'm a little tired of the joke and the title already.
But tell me about the book itself.
Well, I wrote the piece, This Old Man. I started the piece in 2013, I think late in the year, and I think handed it to you along about February, something like that.
It came as a complete surprise to me. Just plopped it on my desk, done.
I wrote it in different pieces because I didn't quite know what I was doing, and it was about physical debility, and it starts off with a description of my arthritic hands. And
which you say the tips of your fingers look like they've been the subject of torture by the KGB.
If I point my forefinger at you like a pistol and fire it up for your nose, I'd hit you in the knee. But I describe some of the everyday debilities of age. And I didn't quite know what I was doing, but I knew that loss was at the middle of this. I had lost my wife. We've been married for 48 years. And I'd lost a daughter, and a beloved dog of Carol's and mine went out the fifth floor window in the middle of jumped out the window on the fifth floor and was killed. Losses for people my age are common. Ed Hirsch, the wonderful poet, lost his son and wrote a great book about it last year. And he says that anybody over the age of 65 has a 100-pound bag of cement of loss on his shoulders. And he writes about writing about the loss of his son and said to, he says, you can't make a story out of it. You can't do that with a life. So I didn't know how to touch on these subjects, and I didn't know if I wanted to even. And I did so actually through the loss of the dog. And I'd written a piece about losing my wife, losing Carol, called Over the Wall, which sort of began this process. And I waited 6 months, and just after the first Obama election, she died in April. And I said she didn't know this news, and she didn't know about the hurricane that fall, and a lot of things she didn't know. And I said the dead don't know what's happening, and the dead leave quickly. And I quoted a Kenneth Koch poem, say, les morts vont vite, the dead go quickly. And there's a line in that which says, no more scenes in the bedroom, no more waiting in the hall, waiting to say hello with mixed feelings. Perfect line. I described the death of Harry, this dog, and then threw in that Carol and I wept. We couldn't get over weeping for him. And he lay in our bathroom between us on the floor, and we threw Kleenex back and forth. And I said we were also weeping for my daughter Callie, who had committed suicide a couple of years earlier. And events that we knew we couldn't just get our minds around in any way, but it was for both. But I don't want to dwell on this. I didn't want to make much of this because everybody's experienced loss. And there are many changes of mood through this piece. I patched the thing together, and some of the sadder little moments, paragraphs that are hard to take are often followed by a joke or a lighter moment. And there's some actual jokes in there, and is okay because I like to take jokes. I count on jokes myself. I'm known to tell jokes.
And there's also the opposite of loss. There's new love.
Yes, and this was happening. I was finding someone new in my life, my present wife, Peggy, and this was going on.
And desire.
I wanted to say that, and time was going by, and I was still engaged in life. And I said that old people are like everyone else. We need connection. We need love. We need intimate love.
And a hand on the shoulder. I mean, there's sex. I mean, the piece ends with, in a sense, life against all other things.
Against all odds, yes. But I wanted to say what was happening with me, which happens with other old people. Old people fall in love. Old people have love life, have intimate connections, have sex lives. And people don't like to admit this, mostly their children, but
because they're somehow revolted by it.
But I think people are getting over this because it's now known. I mean, it's not something to be repelled by. It's something to be grateful for. This brings up something else, which I've noticed with writers that I've dealt with. Now and then, if a writer lives long enough, this didn't just happen much with American writers. The famous thing about American writers was there are no second acts in American lives for writers. But writers that go on and on often go back, as Updike did, go back to the same subjects again and again. He went back to his mother, to the sandstone field farmhouse, to his father, to his teenage courting years, and did the same story really again and again, but much better each time with increased feeling. some of the very best stories he wrote for us were at the very end. And the same thing happened with another writer of mine that I edited over a period of 40 years, V.S. Pritchett, the great British writer. In his middle 80s, suddenly got on this amazing hot streak writing some of the greatest stories of his life, full of sex, full of amour, and adventures and comedy and childhood things all rushing out of him. And I think that all of us do this at any age because we basically go over the same material in our minds again and again, the stories that really mean a lot to us. And it's not we're trying to get them right, but we're not trying to change the outcome, but we're trying to keep them or to say, was this the way it was? And psychologists and experts on the subject say that this is what memory is. It isn't just a defensive thing to protect us from falling out of a tree when the tiger's passing by, but it is a trying out of a scenario again and again because it may be of use. That's what memory is. And this is why the same scenes recur. After I wrote scenes, a lot of this personal stuff I used to have dreams about or think about over, and once I put them down and get them published, I don't think about them anymore. It's very strange. It goes away.
When you go back and read your earlier stuff, do you recognize it? Does it feel like you?
Not the very early stuff. No, it feels like Hemingway.
And can you relate it all to a decision like Philip Roth's to stop writing?
Well, I haven't got there yet. I'm thinking of not blogging anymore because I don't think my blogs are quite up to what they were. But
I'll be the judge of that. Keep going. Well, please,
no,
keep
I don't,
going.
I don't want to stop. I like to have it still going on a little bit. And then this way, once again, I think I'm extremely lucky. I'm 95 and still writing. My goodness. I mean, I'm startled and very happy.
I'm happy to be here with you always, Roger. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you, David.
The great Roger Angel. He's the author of many books on baseball and the essay collection This Old Man, All in Pieces. Our interview was from 2015. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. Wherever you are, I hope you're healthy, and I hope you stay that way. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.